This is Lisa Miller & Associates, Florida Insurance Roundup, your podcast on the people, issues, and regulations shaping Florida's insurance market. Now, here's Lisa Miller.
Welcome, friends. This is a true roundup, as we have not one, but two great topics that we will discuss today. The first is condominium association underwriting in the wake of Surfside, Florida, where Champlain Towers collapsed, killing 98 residents tragically. So far, at least five other high-rise buildings in Miami-Dade County have since been partially or fully evacuated, being deemed unsafe. So the question is, who will insure Florida's high-rise condominium associations going forward? And under what conditions or exceptions? And what impact will this have on the already declining availability and affordability of property insurance in Florida? And our second topic, the new Senate Bill 76 pre-suit settlement law that's part of Florida's broader new property insurance reform that took effect in June of this year. It requires that insurance companies be notified with a 10-day notice and demand before a lawsuit is filed by first parties, such as homeowners or commercial building owners. And it establishes how carriers need to respond. We're going to provide some definitive direction on how the law is supposed to work, as it's already coming into play in court. So joining us today on the Florida Insurance Roundup is insurance defense attorney Michael Monteverde of the Zenober, Diana, and Monteverde Law Firm. He manages their South Florida office in Fort Lauderdale, in the heart of the condo belt, as I like to say. Michael's expertise includes handling commercial residential insurance contract litigation for insurance companies. Welcome back to our program, Michael.
Thank you, Lisa. Thank you for having me.
And joining us from what I call the Western Riviera or Lower Alabama is Brian Squire, Managing Executive Senior Vice President of Hays Companies in Destin. Hays is a national consulting insurance agency specializing in risk management, insurance, and employee benefits. And of course, it's associated with Brown & Brown Insurance Brokerage. Brian, welcome back to our roundup.
Thank you for having me, Lisa. Good to be back.
I appreciate you, gentlemen, so much for spending some time with us today. So, Michael, let's start with you. You're intimately familiar with Senate Bill 76. We did a podcast with you. Share with us a specific portion that I want to focus on today, which is the pre-suit demand notice. And in layman's terms, that means you can't sue an insurance company unless you tell them what you're suing them about. Can you talk to us about that, Michael?
Yeah, I can, and I'll just kind of address it relatively kind of broadly and give a real broad overview without getting into too much of the details. But essentially, what the new statute and what SB 76 intended to do was to give carriers the ability to kind of have some kind of notice or notification from an insured or, you know, I guess in some ways it might even be safer to say from the attorneys, a notice that a lawsuit was going to be filed to give them the ability to try to resolve some of this, to cut down on the just out of control litigation that's going on in Florida that we're all well aware of. And so what the mandatory pre-suit notice requirement did was it essentially gave or required an insured who ultimately plans on filing a lawsuit to give a 10-day notice to the insurance company advising them of the pre-suit demand and what they're looking for. And then it gives the insurance carrier some time to address that demand and respond to it. And then ultimately, if there can't be a resolution within the time periods laid out based on the pre-suit notice demand in the statute, then ultimately a lawsuit will ensue. But some of the benefits that are kind of baked into that, or at least intended benefits, really hasn't totally played out yet, is are there fee shifting mechanisms and obligations and requirements that ultimately will make lawsuits less prevalent? Or even if the lawsuits do end up going forward, do they kind of incentivize early resolution to kind of take away the burden on the courts, attorneys, and carriers themselves with respect to litigation costs and exposure?
This was effective in, you know, June. Actually, July 1 was the start date of this notice requirement. And from my intelligence, most law firms are complying with it. There's a few that seem to be a bit confused about the law's application. Can you talk about that confusion, policy effective date versus all lawsuits, and how you see or the way you read the law? To me, it says all lawsuits, but there seems to be confusion in the marketplace.
Well, there is some confusion in the marketplace, and I think that the confusion was born out of, in a lot of ways, what ended up happening with the similar assignment of benefits reform from 2019. And, you know, it seemed to many of us on the defense side that that law was meant to apply as of its effective date in July of 2019, and that that was supposed to apply to any assignment of benefits contract that had been signed after that date. There were a number of courts in Florida that looked at it completely different and pinned that to the date of the policy, and therefore started talking about retroactive and substantive application. There's still a lot of discussion of that with respect to this law as well, and there is some confusion as to whether or not it applies to all of the claims that are being made and all of the pre-suit notice requirements, or whether it does not. That really is going to be borne out in the courts, and it's going to probably have to work its way through the courts. But I would tend to agree with you, and it seems that most of the attorneys on the policyholder side are trying to comply with the pre-suit notice requirement. And it seems like the early indications are that there are some interesting trends, which we can talk about in a moment. But I think last I checked, last I spoke to somebody, they said that if you went onto the portal, there's already 1,500, I believe, pre-suit notice requirements, or maybe more than that. I may be off on that number, but it seems like there are a lot of them being filed with the state and being forwarded onto the carriers for the carriers to then address and deal with as they deem fit.
Thank you for mentioning that portal, Michael, and we'll put in our show notes the link to the portal. It's a public record, and we can see these notices, etc. I got this question from the audience, Michael. I'd like you to respond to it, and then we'll turn over some of this airtime to Brian, that even if an insurance company gets a notice complying with the law, and of course the insurance company has to pay you, of course, to continue on with this lawsuit, and then the plaintiff firm says, okay, I'll give you 10 days notice. What does the insurance company gain by getting the notice? Do you think it's good for consumers, transparency in the case? What is good about this pre-suit notice? And to all of our plaintiff lawyers that are listening to this, and I work with them as well as defense lawyers, most of the plaintiff lawyers I've spoken to said, you know, it's a good idea. It brings all the parties to the table. I'm hoping that this podcast will encourage that good behavior. So what are your thoughts, Michael, about the good of this pre-suit notice?
So it's interesting, and a lot of this is anecdotal, just from talking to clients who have been dealing with it, but some of the results or consequences of this so far have been somewhat encouraging. And it really, I think, depends on how the carriers are addressing them. So you have certain insurance companies that are taking a very detailed and analytical approach to it. And they are trying to come up with responses to the pre-suit demands that maybe will really try to facilitate an early resolution. And what you can kind of do if you set this up correctly with your response is you can try to address some of the issues that I think have plagued the system and plagued Florida for a long time, which is, you know, the tail wagging the dog of the attorney's fees. And 627-428 was always the elephant in the room. You know, you have a $20,000 roof claim, but also that $20,000 roof claim is really a $500,000 roof claim because everybody's stacking the attorney's fees and costs behind it, you know, fears of multipliers and everything else. So it made the way to analyze a claim completely kind of unique to that world and kind of unique to Florida, because other states have fee statutes, but none that really mirror what we have or had here in Florida as it pertains to these types of claims. So there were, I'll say it nicely, there were certain attorneys and law firms that we would deal with on the policyholder side who would purposefully inflate demands or purposefully withhold demands solely for the purpose of drumming up the attorney's fees. And I won't be long-winded, but I'll give kind of an example. If you have a $40,000 case, you might have somebody who comes in and demands some amount well beyond that, and kind of stick to that. And then only towards the end of the case, come back down to earth and say, oh, well, wait a second, maybe it is a $40,000 case, but hey, guess what? I've litigated the case now for 2.5 years. So now you have to pay me $160,000 in attorney's fees on top of it for your $40,000 case. So pay me $200,000. And the carriers sometimes would have their kind of, you know, hands tied, because they'd say, well, we knew it was a $40,000 case from day one, but you wouldn't even entertain that. So it allowed some game playing. And sure, there are ways that you could have battled that. PFSs, potentially, when we used to be able to use Danis offers, that probably doesn't work as well anymore because of this. But some of those things were always going to be applied after the fact, which meant that really, I don't think many people on the plaintiff's bar really worried about it, because they knew they could probably always run back and ultimately be able to resolve the case before they ever got to those consequences down the road. So what does this do? Well, because of the way that the fee provision kind of shifts under the new statute and under SB 76, what the insurance carriers can do is they can set up the offers in response to the demands in a way that really kind of dares really the plaintiff's attorneys, not the insurers, but the plaintiff's attorneys to reject the offer. Because now we are setting up a situation where the fees are either limited or completely done away with, and each party to bear its own fees and costs depending on what you are ultimately able to recover in the lawsuit. So it gives the insurance carriers the opportunity to say, okay, that's what you're demanding. Here's my response. Here's my response to that demand. And I've really like analyzed this, and I think that this response is very fair. And if you don't accept this, you may ultimately be gambling with what you're able to recover from a fee perspective. So it really has helped, I think, in that way. And then the other thing I think it does is it takes away the incentive to overly demand. So if you have a $70,000 case, there's no reason to come in and demand $600,000 to try to move the needle, because you may just be shooting yourself in the foot based on the way that the insurance carrier ultimately responds to that pre-suit demand. So it creates more of a chess game to try to get everybody to a place where there is a reasonable number and everybody should be kind of close when it's all said and done with, if they're trying to use the statute in the way that it's supposed to be used. So then what'll be left are the ones where there just really are just wide-ranging disputes, where an insured thinks they're entitled to $200,000 and the insurance company says, look, we don't, we think you're entitled to 10. Those are all still going to get litigated, but those ones in the middle, it probably is going to help resolve them earlier on.
Very, very helpful, Michael. And I hope, again, those that are listening to this podcast will give great thought and give great weight to working together, parties at the table, trying to ultimately help our consumers get their claims paid and their lives put back together. So I'm going to turn this over to Brian. And Brian and I talk frequently about the market in the commercial residential space since that horrible tragedy. And we've never really ever seen an event like that. We hope we never see it again. And, you know, Miami-Dade is continuing its emergency inspections. I think I saw another city yesterday has invoked these inspections on a regular basis. So, Brian, I'll have you talk about, when you hear Michael talk about the noise, if you will, in the marketplace, litigation, you know, yin and yang between defense attorneys and plaintiff lawyers, does that have an effect on the market where you're trying to place this commercial residential coverage, and couple that with Surfside? What are the markets saying to you, Brian? We'd love your perspective.
Well, I think we really need to back up and look at the fundamental reason why these things are happening. And we talk about systemic issues, what caused Champlain Towers collapse. I have no idea. But what I do know is that the systemic issue that we do face when we're looking at these condominium buildings really stems from the maintenance and how these associations are governed. You have a board of directors that make decisions on behalf of the association, but then the condominium association's governing documents allow its members to veto the board's decision. these decisions made regarding the maintenance of these associations in a lot of cases are based on cost first, then life safety. This mindset needs to change. I don't have all the answers to it, but there's a two-pronged approach that I would look at doing is fixing the current situation with all the existing condominium buildings. Maybe you do this through engineering studies. Maybe you do this through pre-qualification of underwriting through the insurance carriers. Maybe you do this through legislative changes.
Brian, that is great input. And I often wonder about board members that are sitting on these condo boards and how they're feeling right now in the aftermath of Surfside, and where they may have deferred maintenance or not want to talk about maintenance. And how do we as a state encourage routine maintenance? And not so much as a state, but from an insurance company standpoint, Brian, let's say, you know, pre-Surfside, post-Surfside. Can you share with us how you're seeing the dynamics of underwriting changing based on Surfside? What are the markets and the companies saying to their renewal condominium association customers? What demands do you think they're going to put in, you know, in front of these condo boards so that they will insure these properties, Brian?
Lisa, I think it's a mixed bag. We're seeing some associations take a more proactive approach in response to these type of maintenance issues. However, at the same time, we've had multiple associations that have had decisions levied against them recently where they've put cost first and they've not made decisions to fix the building, whether it's made at the board level or it's made at the ownership level. And this is a continued problem because they're focused on cost over life safety. What the insurance carriers are going to be looking at is how do they avoid a Champlain Towers crisis? And we've had multiple conversations. I've had multiple conversations with insurance carriers across the board, and we don't have a solution yet. We've talked about requiring engineering studies. What does that look like? One thing I do hear is that the insurance carriers have been focused so much on the year built. And the 40-year number or 30-year number seems to be a number that everybody throws out. But in my opinion, I think you need to wipe away looking at just the age of the building. This needs to be applied to any year-built building because I've seen in my career, I've been in the business for 21 years, I've seen newly constructed buildings have issues similar to a Champlain Towers. So we really need to wipe away the mindset that this is only needs to be applied to a 40-year building. Don't have the answer on what year it should be, but maybe you do an engineering study every 5 years or a condition study. But wipe away the year that needs to be applied to these buildings because I think that's a fallacy. Insurance carriers are also talking about doing more detailed inspections on an annual basis. When you write an insurance policy, the insurance carrier, upon binding an account, will go out and do a detailed insurance inspection. I think that detailed on-site inspection is going to be more detailed moving forward, looking at structural issues. And if the inspector doing the inspection sees something, they're going to make a note, and I think it's going to be elevated. In years past, these notes have maybe just filed away at the insurance carrier level, but I think these inspections are going to be elevated if they see something wrong. But we've talked about other things that could be applied from an underwriting standpoint. Having board of directors sign affidavits confirming that there are no outstanding maintenance issues. The insurance carriers are also talking about reviewing past board minutes, something that's never been done. Property insurance carriers collecting financial statements, that usually never happens. So there's a lot of things that the insurance carriers are tossing around at this point. But without having a kind of a clear picture on how to fix it, there's just a lot of speculation that's going on in the marketplace right now.
So if I'm a condo board member, Brian, put your board member hat on, not your insurance agent hat. How do I make my risk more attractive? Because really, if I'm an insurance carrier, I can pick and choose who I insure and who I don't. I mean, that's what underwriting is all about. What advice could you give to condo board members, you know, from a packaging up standpoint without waiting for an insurance company to demand these documents? What are the top four or five things they can put together and get to you when you're trying to place this coverage in the marketplace?
Well, to keep it really simple, replacing roofs. Roofs over the last 4 or 5 years have become a number one concern for all insurance companies. And even though it may not be right, the insurance carriers have placed typically a 10 to 12 year lifespan on any roof. And that applies to a shingle roof, to a flat roof, which is based on, which is comprised of concrete. So if I were making a suggestion to a board to package up their building to an insurance carrier, what's going to make it look better? Replacing or maintaining a roof, making sure that you have impact windows. Those are really the two items that can easily be addressed and shown to the insurance carrier that you've met some basic underwriting guidelines that the carrier may have in place. The engineering studies, I don't know what that's going to look like, but I think that's going to be a component to what the insurance carriers are going to look like. So I think there's going to be more to come regarding that issue as we move forward.
Very, very helpful. And from your perspective, Brian, and for those listening, there is a collection of stakeholders being led by the Building Officials Association of Florida. We will put an article and notes about that group for any of you that want to participate in that group. It's got the International Code Council, which of course are the building code experts in the world. You have the Florida Bar looking at condo laws, Chapter 718, and how to improve that. And of course, you have a great leader in Senator Jason Pizzo, whose district is where Surfside is, and he spent every day and probably is still there working on issues and legislation that will address what needs to be done from a condo governance standpoint. So, Brian, I'll let you close your section of this great roundup with your final perspective, what we're going to see in what I'll call the renewal season in 2022. Any other final thoughts that you have for those listening about how they might get their risk insured?
Well, I think we're going to see increased tightening from the marketplace. There's lots of documents going around the state right now regarding percentage increases for expectations on these insurance renewals. We're seeing 20-25%. Now, in my opinion, you just can't broadly apply that to every association. So my recommendation from a cost perspective is to reach out to your insurance professional and have them review your account. There's more that goes into it than just what the market's demanding. So have your insurance agent review what's going on with your specific account, and you can hopefully come up with a cost expectation. As far as, again, things to look at, if you've got an older roof, you really need to address the roof more so than having impact glass windows. But if you can address the roof in a timely manner before your renewal, it's going to be very important. And that not only applies to commercial residential, but that's for any risk here in the state.
Thank you for that, Brian. And Mike, back over to you, your final perspective. We have a legislative session in January. We have our first committee week in September, a couple of October, November, where some, as they're saying, tweaks to Senate Bill 76 to kind of clarify some of the ambiguities there. There will be special committees set up in the House and Senate to explore what happened with Surfside, how we have it never happen again. These burning issues are facing Floridians and our legislature. For your purposes, if you were king for a day, what would you leave our listeners with to think about as we move into the coming months?
I think two things, and I'll piggyback off of what you and Brian were just talking about. I think that one of the things that we noticed during the course of Wilma litigation, and then even more so during Irma litigation, and then a lot of times this comes up in separate litigation unrelated to insurance and in the construction defect world, is you come across condominium associations that are not properly reserved. And for the listeners who don't know what that means, under Chapter 718 of the Florida statutes, there are certain funds that an association collects through its maintenance payments that are put into basically certain buckets. And those buckets are statutorily created, and the money in those buckets cannot be used for anything other than what it is set aside for, unless there is a full vote of the entire membership, not just the board. So if you have 100 unit owners, you'd have to have 100 unit owners vote, or at least a quorum of them to vote to ultimately determine if that money can be used for something else. Well, why is that important? it's important because, you know, you can take a whole host of examples. I mean, Champlain Towers is, you know, tragically maybe one of them, but they're all over the state where you have buildings and associations that are built in, let's say, 1980, and then you get to, you know, 2021, and they say, well, we need new roofs. And what you find out is what you're allowed to do under the statute is you are allowed to basically disclaim or reject reserve funding. And you can say, we're not going to actually put money in our reserve funding accounts. We'll just deal with it as it comes. And we'll go day by day, and we'll pay for that when it comes due. Well, you kick the can down the road, and then you get to a place where you don't have the money to replace 30 roofs on a 30 building property to the tune of, you know, $12 million or $15 million or whatever it is. So what ends up happening is that a storm comes along, and then next thing you know, probably out of desperation, probably because there's some opportunistic people who get in the middle of it, all of a sudden now an insurance claim is made, and now we're dealing with this in the terms of a first party property dispute when it really could have been resolved had the properties just been properly reserved. So if I were advising a carrier, I would say, look, in your underwriting processes, make sure that people are properly reserving. Make sure that the maintenance funds are going where they're supposed to be, because they're turning the insurance policies in some instances into maintenance contracts. And that's not what they are, right? They're there for certain specified losses that are not excluded. So, you know, I don't think that this has been done enough in the past where people are going in and looking at how has the association's boards or successive boards, how are they handling the maintenance of the building? How are they overseeing how the building is maintained before accepting the risk? And the last thing I would say is I was involved in a case. I won't say necessarily where or what it was, other than to say that it was dealing with a window issue on a large high rise. And the reason that the window lawsuit was being filed against the window subcontractor, the window contractor, was because the building actually had to do a concrete restoration project that they hadn't reserved for, had no money for. And so it was robbing Peter to pay Paul. When I was out there, one of the consultants who was there for one of the parties said, oh yeah, this is happening on every building that was built in the 1970s or 80s or 60s on the beach, because the salt water gets in, nobody's painting like they should. Nobody follows up on painting, you know, how often you're supposed to paint a building. Nobody follows up on how often you're supposed to be caulking windows. And when these things are not monitored by anyone, and then an insurance company comes and insures that risk, they don't know what they're buying because they can't see what's behind those walls. And so some of the stuff that Brian was talking about with respect to yearly inspections or biannual inspections, those things are probably all something that those are things that I think insurance carriers should consider, because there are a lot of these kind of festering problems that nobody sees. And I don't think they'll, hopefully, you know, God willing, none of them will be as tragic as what Champlain Towers was, but there may be other issues that arise on a smaller scale, but that do cause problems in the market as time goes on. So it's just something, those are the things that I would really look to if I were trying to consider how do we kind of put a clamp down on rising premiums, rising costs, litigation costs, and all of these things that seem to be spiraling out of control.
Wonderful perspective, Mike. Maintenance first. That sounds like the theme of this podcast for those that are in the commercial residential space, impact windows, you know, making sure your roof is intact, hold that roof down, and consult with your insurance professional. Great advice from the both of you. And I'd like to thank our guest today, Michael Monteverde with the Zenobra Diana Monteverde Law Firm, based out of their Fort Lauderdale office, and Brian Squire on the other end of the state in Destin, Managing Executive Senior Vice President at the Hays Company. These two great stakeholders, Americans, Floridians, and professionals doing what they can to make things better in the commercial insurance and litigation marketplace. In our podcast show notes, we'll have a link to various reports, a way to reach these incredible speakers today, you know, a summary of this conversation. You know, we take the notes so you don't have to. And we want you to like this podcast and share it with your colleagues and friends who have their own social media platforms. And of course, we really like to hear from you. You know, are there checks and balances in the system that could be made better? Do you have suggestions? Do you want to participate in some of these gatherings that are happening across our state in light of Champlain Towers and the collapse, call us. Leave a comment on our on-air platform, 850-388-8002. That's our phone number. And you can also email me, Lisa Miller, at lisamillerassociates.com. We just appreciate you taking the time to listen and to follow our work. And we want to have you stay close to us so we can try and give great input to some of these weighty issues facing our state. And with that, that's a wrap for our Florida Insurance Roundup for this edition. We thank you for being a part of this. And remember, at Lisa Miller & Associates, we've got a passion for public policy and client success. I'm Lisa Miller, and until next time, please stay safe.
This has been Lisa Miller & Associates Florida Insurance Roundup, your podcast on the people, issues, and regulations shaping Florida's insurance market. For more information on today's program, please visit us on the web at www.lisamillerassociates.com.